Hi, I'm Doug Gordon, and you're listening to Beta on Wisconsin Public Radio. Karen Russell is a MacArthur Foundation genius. Her novel Swamplandia was a Pulitzer Prize finalist. Now she has a new collection of short stories called Orange World. Karen's stories are often surprising and surreal, and many of them deal with nature and the physical world.
You know, it's a funny thing with the collection. I think for the first couple stories, you're just kind of rediscovering what your preoccupations are. And part of the thrill of kind of working on stories over this kind of long stretch of time is you start to see what notes recur, and then you can kind of consciously build out these connections.
How much of your interest in the natural world do you think comes from being born and raised in Florida?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, probably 100%.
Yeah.
I was just looking through some old photographs, actually. My dad is in town, and it was such a nice reminder that, wow, we really did have this unbelievable childhood in South Florida. There was a picture of my siblings and I watching this albino peacock walk down our street.
Oh, wow.
This was just like a normal occurrence, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
We were lucky enough that we lived right by the water, and we lived by this kind of mangrove estuary that we called the Muck. And what was exciting about that place as a kid, it was like a little swamp and microcosm, sort of. But totally liminal place, you know, very unclear where the land ended and where the ocean began. And our neighbor had kind of this muddy canal running behind his house, which, you know, as a mother now, it would terrify me to let my kids play by.
But
yeah, it was really just, you know, there were always kind of blue heron and all kinds of exciting crustaceans. And Florida, you know, for people who have visited, everyone's aware that it's really inescapable. You can't deny that you're a part of nature. The humidity alone is always just engulfing you.
Your stories are so grounded in the physical world, and your settings are so richly textured and so three-dimensional. Is setting the first place your imagination goes to when you're creating a story?
Yeah, I mean, more often than not, it really is. I think maybe in my first collection, there were a few more stories that began as kind of what would happen if counterfactuals. But really, I think I need to have some sense of the landscape before I feel comfortable starting anything. I mean, even before I know the characters, sometimes I need to kind of have a sense of, you know, what setting am I going to cordon off in this particular story? What's the world going to be?
Yeah. So then once you've decided on what the world is going to be, so how do you go about deciding what kind of characters should inhabit each of these various worlds?
Oh, yeah. Well, that's always a surprise, too, a little bit, you know.
So you don't put a lot of thought, you don't create character biographies or anything, and you don't do that. You just sort of go into it and start writing?
Yeah, I think I have to sort of, that's the only way I know how to get to know these people, and it can take multiple drafts. You know, there's a story in here, the tornado auction, and I had gone on this kind of research trip to Nebraska, to the Sandhills of Nebraska, and I made a good friend out there, Doug Johnson, who just took me up in his crop duster and introduced me sort of to this incredible world. And I got to meet some older kind of ranchers and farmers in the area. And so in that case, you know, there's the voice in that story. It's this kind of 76-year-old retired breeder of literal weather, of actual tornadoes.
Yeah.
But he's sort of an amalgam of some of these real people that I met out there.
I just love the idea that these people are bidding. It's similar to a horse auction, isn't it? Like, these people are bidding on tornadoes.
Yes.
It's such a great premise, and you execute it so well. Yeah, I want to ask you about The Bad Graft. Can you give us kind of a brief synopsis of this story without revealing any or very few spoilers?
Oh, sure. So this is a crazy story that I had been thinking for a while. I wanted to try to revise one of these myths from the Metamorphoses. And the one that I was haunted by was Daphne and Apollo, right? So Apollo chases Daphne, and she makes this kind of cruel existential bargain where she survives, but it's by becoming a tree, which just felt very resonant to me as kind of a strategy that many people use, you know, if you want to kind of extend the metaphor to what we see people do kind of after, you know, when they're threatened, when they're traumatized. But I wanted to sort of flip it and reverse it and imagine what it would be like if a tree made a leap into a human woman, you know, how that might work.
Yeah.
So I had been thinking about this idea for a little bit, and I went on my first date with my now husband to Joshua Tree National Park and just felt completely resized and terrified in a wonderful way by the desert. I had never seen this particular desert before. I hadn't really spent that much time in this kind of ecosystem, and I thought it was thrilling. So this is like a long-winded synopsis, but the story is kind of a love triangle between very young couple that are on a road trip. They think that they're going to be kind of vagabonds and wanderers. And then on this trip, the girl pricks her finger on a Joshua tree. There's this uncanny merger. She is infiltrated by the plant's spirit. And the story sort of proceeds from there. It's a very unstable geometry between this woman, the tree spirit, and her boyfriend.
Yeah, and that finger prick, that's like straight out of Grimm's fairy tales, isn't it?
Isn't it, though?
Yeah, yeah. It's great, though. But the story just, wow, that story really, well, they all did, but I mean, that one really knocked me out, and now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt from it.
Oh, sure
thing. And you can set it up if you like.
So this is right after that kind of fairy tale moment where she pricks her finger on a spine of this ancient tree. At first, the Joshua tree is elated to discover that it's alive. I survived my leap. I was not annihilated. Whatever I was. Grafted to the girl's consciousness, the plant becomes aware of itself. It dreams its green way up into her eye stalks and peers out. Standing there, in the mirror of the desert, are 100 versions of itself. Here is its home, a six-armed hulk, fibrous and fruiting obscenely under a noon sun. Here is the locust that recently contained this tree spirit. For a tree, this is a dreadful experience. Its uprooted awareness floats throughout the alien form. It concentrates itself behind Angie's eyeballs, where there's moisture. This insoluble spirit, this refugee from the Joshua tree, understands itself to have leapt into hell, the wrong place, the wrong vessel. It pulses outward in a fuzzy frenzy of investigation, flares greener, sends out feelers. Compared with the warm and expansive desert soil, the human body is a cul-de-sac. This newborn ghost has only just begun to apprehend itself when its fragile tendency is threatened. Angie sneezes, rubs at her temple. Unaware that this is an immunologic reflex, she is convulsed by waves of nostalgia for earlier selves, remote homes. Here, for some reason, is her childhood backyard, filled with anarchic wildflowers and bordered by Pennsylvania hemlock. Then the pain dismantles her memory. She holds her head in her hand, cries for Andy. This is the plant fighting back. The girl moans, "Andy, don't you have any medicine, Advil, something?" The vegetable invader feels the horror of its imprisonment. Its new host is walking away from the Joshua Tree forest, following Andy. What can this kind of survival mean?
I'm curious about how you go about inhabiting the mind of a Joshua tree. I'm guessing that one of the biggest challenges would be trying not to Disney-fy it, not to anthropomorphize the tree.
Oh, it's very tricky, isn't it? There was it's a classic of kind of science fiction, John Wyndham's The Day of the Triffids.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I read that years ago. So was that on your mind at all when you wrote this?
I must have been deep in the very back, yeah. You know, in the deep folds of the brain or something.
Mm-hmm.
It's tough for me to source sometimes, you know, what the influences are. But I do sort of think imagining a very different kind of way of existing, you know, grafting onto a human being. One of the things that was challenging but pleasurable was sort of thinking about what would that estranged perspective make of the way humans live in time, you know, the speed at which we're moving through time, how totally unmoored we are, you know, relative to mm-hmm. something like an ancient tree mm-hmm. with this vast kind of root system. And so in a way, you know, I really nerded out on kind of learning about this incredible millennial love story between a particular species of moth and the Joshua tree.
Mm-hmm.
And that gave me a way to think about what's beautiful, but also maybe terrifying about really grappling with how profoundly interdependent we all are. You know, you have this illusion that you're this discrete entity, and then you discover, no, my borders are totally porous. And, you know, in the case of this honeymooning couple, I think there is something terrifying, right, about saying I'm going to yoke my life to another person's life and our fates will be intertwined.
Oh, yeah.
That's sort of the shadow side of a love story, right, that it can kind of shade into a horror story at certain moments if you're dealing with this kind of collision of instinct. So I did want to just think about, and I had a lot of fun thinking about what a Joshua Tree would find upsetting or hilarious or maybe familiar about being a human being.
Another one of the standout stories is The Gondoliers. Can you tell us a bit about this one?
Yeah, I'm so happy you enjoyed it because this story nearly broke me. It just took me a very long time to sort of navigate my own way through.
Was that because it's about your home state?
I just think I was very stubbornly committed to sort of the wrong trajectory for this story for a while. You know, you kind of dig in. And it was even the wrong point of view for a while. And so I had to make my peace with sort of starting afresh a little bit. But the world of the story has always been the same. And it's a drowned South Florida in a near-ish future. And it's told from the point of view of one of four sisters they're sort of these mutant women who have evolved and kind of consciously evolved this ability to navigate the canals of this new Florida by echolocating. So, you know, they sing and the echoes of their voices return to them kind of a map of submerged objects and obstacles, and that they're able to sort of anticipate what the river is going to do next and move with it. I love the idea of these kind of chorusing women, the secret power that's kind of developing inside of them and between them.
Yeah. You write such beautiful sentences, and it makes me think of one of my favorite quotes about sentences is from Don DeLillo. The quote is, "The sentences I'm working on generate the ideas that tend to lead to more sentences." Does that quote resonate with you?
I love that. Yeah. Yes. You know, Charlie D'Ambrosio is somebody else who, he's just an artist of the sentence, and I've heard him say, you know, it's almost, he follows the sound first, and with luck, the music leads him to the meaning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I really do find that to be true in a funny way. I have to kind of be conscious of how much I love rhymes and half rhymes. No, you know, nobody wants to inadvertently write a story-length lullaby.
Yeah.
But there is something about following like a round sound forward, and it can, in like a rainbow scarf kind of way, you know, lead to another thought and another thought. And it's surprising the kind of circuitry of sound, what it can lead you to.
Yeah. Let's talk about the title story, Orange World. Can you give us kind of a Cliff's Notes summary of Orange World?
Yeah, this was a real new kind of story to try for me. And in some ways, I thought maybe the riskiest story for me to try to write. And it's a story about this woman who has a difficult pregnancy and makes a deal with the devil, she believes, to protect her son, to ensure that her son will be born healthy. And then sort of finds herself getting blackmailed by this huckster demon who the deal is that as long as she nurses him every night, he'll make sure that her son doesn't die.
Now would be a great time to have you read an excerpt.
The gutter is a cold canoe. Ray lowers onto an elbow, stretching flat. Asphalt pushes at her shoulders, her tailbone. It seems impossible that she hasn't gotten sick yet in all these weeks of appointments. Perhaps the devil is keeping her well. She tries not to look at it. When she looks at it, her milk dries up. It lays its triangular head on her collarbone, using its thin-fingered paws to squeeze milk from her left breast into its hairy snout. Its tail curls around her waist. Unlike her son, the devil has dozens of irregular teeth, fanged and broken, in three rows. Some lie flat against the gums, like bright arrowheads in green mud. Its lips make a cold collar around her nipple. She feels the tugging deep in her groin, a menstrual aching. Milk gushes out of her, more milk than it seems any single body could possibly produce. More milk, she's sure, than her baby ever gets. Below her, the devil makes a queer, gurgling sound. Tonight, it has a long, paddle-like tail, erratically needled, like a balding cactus, which lashes at her side. She feels blood racing away from a fresh cut. It drinks. More milk floods around its lips, turning its fur shiny and wet.
This story reminded me of Ira Levin's novel, Rosemary's Baby, and the movie based on it. Your story kind of seems like a sequel, Rosemary's Baby Part 2. Was Rosemary's Baby on your mind at all when you were writing
this?
Yeah,
it must have been. It's so funny, isn't it? You sort of don't always know, I think, what the mulch is.
Right, because you're too busy down there in the weeds about creating the story. So,
right.
Yeah.
And I think sometimes when people talk about influence, you know, there's a temptation to want to just to say, well, it was Nabokov, obviously, you know, or just sort of you want to cite these literary greats. But part of the horror in this story for me, it was just, I don't know that I had been connected before to that kind of, this sense of animal pleading, you know, where you so desperately want for the, but I think that must be what, you know, that's not just limited to, you know, new motherhood. I think anyone who has ever been in that bargaining room, where you're suddenly evicted from your ordinary day and you find yourself just on a threshold where you are pleading with whatever is listening to help a loved one or to help yourself, right?
Yeah.
That state has to be universal, I think. And I have been just thinking, you know, more globally, you know, you see the way that fear makes people very vulnerable to all kinds of exploitation, you know, and control. So for me, this story really, I mean, in a very, it's pretty literal. You know, there is like this actual scabby devil that keeps showing up in this woman's gutter.
Yeah. It's also very funny, though, as many of your stories are. It's also very funny, and you have this really uncanny knack to combine horror and humor in your work. How do you do that?
Oh, I hope so. I think that can be a little bit of a tricky thing, you know, but sometimes I also feel if something is just too monotone, if it's only dark, or if it's just you know, a laugh a minute, it both can feel false to me in a way, you know, because I just think it's almost like the way you keep toggling a hologram.
Yeah.
You know, the very same thing can seem maybe there's something hilarious about it, and just like deadly serious, very frightening.
I think it's only a matter of time until the word Russell-esque is added to dictionaries to describe your writing style. So
I hope it's not a pejorative.
I thought it would be a good idea to submit a definition to Merriam-Webster's and Oxford. And so I've taken the liberty of coming up with a rough draft of a definition. Would you mind if I ran it by you?
Oh, no way.
Here we go. Well, yeah, but you haven't heard it yet. But remember, it's a first draft. Here we go. Okay. Russell-esque. Characteristic or reminiscent of the fiction of Karen Russell. Fantastical, surreal realism that uses liminal distortions to find the truth. Haunting, hallucinatory, and humorous. Am I on the right track?
I love that. I love surreal realism.
It's a start, but how would you describe your work?
Oh, I thank you for that. You know, I do get asked a lot about sort of fantasy versus realism, and that binary always feels a little reductive and phony to me because... Yeah. If you're trying to write about anything at all, it's to come at the complexity and strangeness of this life, you know? And, I think some of those distinctions start to break down a little bit for me. And for these characters, you know, often it's true that they're inhabiting some alternate world where, you know, a tree spirit can possess a woman's body, or, you know, you can dance with ghosts on a mountainside, or... You know, a devil might show up outside your house, but particularly with Orange World, you know, I really felt like that was emotional realism. And if there's a devil inside it, it's just in the service of telling a true story.
Karen Russell is the author of the short story collection Orange World. You can find out more about Karen at wpr.org/beta. That does it for this edition of Beta. If you want to hear it again or binge on past episodes, subscribe to the Beta podcast via iTunes or wherever you catch your favorite pods. And make sure to let us know what you think by leaving a rating or a comment. You can keep up with us during the week online at wpr.org/beta or on Twitter at @WPRBeta. Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
That's just flavor to a high life man.
Special thanks to our producer, Carl Christensen.
Carl? Did somebody check my name?
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
You know, for once, I'm a good guy.
I like this humility. It's good.
Adam Friedrich is the show's executive producer.
I am not cloying. I am not needy. I don't care what you think. You're not getting to me.
And thanks to you, our alphas. Until next week, I'm Doug Gordon.
So now suddenly you're going to be an artist. Well, be an artist on your own time.